Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In an unknown and dilapidated laboratory on the University of Wisconsin campus in the 1950s and 1960s, a brilliant alcoholic, work-obsessed psychologist conducted research on love, a notion that was previously ignored and considered unworthy of scientific study. Love at Goon Park, Harry Harlow and the Science of Affection, written by journalist Deborah Blum, is the story of how Professor Harry Harlow, one of the most important and controversial psychologists of the 20th century, altered our understanding of love. I spoke with Deborah Blum from her home in Madison, Wisconsin, and asked her to begin our conversation by describing the emotional bedrock that Harry Harlow sought to discover in his experiments.
Well, Harlow believed, or came to believe, that at some level we all need what he called a solid foundation of affection. That when you take us down layer by layer to what we need emotionally to grow and thrive, and I think of this almost in a geological sense, right? Geologic sense. Where do you put down your roots and really grow strong and healthy and straight? And so when he's taking you down to that emotional bedrock, he's taking you down to what you need to really nurture growth. And he called it as affection. And what's interesting to me about that is that I think he saw affection in a much more complex sense than we tend to allow it to be. We tend to think of affection as patting a puppy, whereas for him, affection was a really uncomplicated, giving, I'm there for you kind of form of love. And at bedrock, he would argue that that's what we need to begin well.
In other words, unconditional love beginning with infancy.
Yes, unconditional love beginning with infancy. And, you know, and not, I think, the other thing you have to see about Harlow is he was really pragmatic about this. So not unconditional love in a sort of warm, squishy sense, but unconditional love in a way that acknowledges that love is work. It, you know, it means you have to pay attention to what another person is telling you, even when you want to go do something else or watch TV or play a game. It means that even when you're tired, you have to be prepared to give. And so he really looks at it as a, you know, put on your work shoes and pull up your gloves and acknowledge that this isn't easy, it's just important.
But you've made a significant jump in the period of a person's life, beginning with unconditional love at infancy, to paying attention to what another person has to say.
Yes.
Obviously, a 3 or 4 year old demands constant attention with what they're saying, but that's considerably different from one adult listening to another.
It is, and you know, I think that that's one of the more interesting leaps if you look at this in a connection. In fact, if you go all the way back to what I'm going to call our pre-verbal state, you know, just a baby who hasn't yet developed language skills, babies tell us things all the time if we're paying attention. Their expression changes. They flirt with us. They smile at us. They'll reach out and, you know, stroke you a little bit and try to make you feel connected. Babies are always trying to tell you things. And some of the more interesting recent work looks at how important it is to really be paying attention to the fact that without words, that baby is talking to you. I think we continue to do that in all kinds of ways throughout our life. And, you know, and I'm not suggesting that we have to hover over each other constantly, you know, taking each other's emotional temperature. But I think that we have to at least be there in our relationships, give any good relationship enough undistracted time that you really can hear what the other person is saying too, and respond to what they're saying. And I think one of the things that we do in our sort of ultra busy lives, and mine is like that, so I'm guilty of this like anyone else, is that we're always giving our friends and our partners and our kids half an ear. Yeah, kind of get it. And I think sometimes it would be worth it to us in the sense of having a richer, more supportive network, and the network is important, if we could slow ourselves down enough just to hear.
Let's work with that topic for a minute, but first let's go back to childhood and infancy in relation to the primates that mm-hmm. Harry Harlow studied. And can you tell us about the studies that he had with the chicken wire model as opposed to the soft cushioned model?
Yeah, I'd love to do that. And it's actually, you know, one of those beautifully simple experiments that you just sets off a light bulb over your head. And to explain the famous cloth mother experiment, I need to tell you that he did this at a time that the field of psychology was really taking an opposite approach and arguing that touch didn't matter, that affection was detrimental to a child because it would weaken moral fiber, I think, was sort of the zeitgeist of the time, that children didn't have a specific relationship with a parent. Any, you know, big warm body would do as long as it would feed the child. And almost psychology was trying to boil down the parent-child relationship to something like a B.F. Skinner pigeon. You know, the mother or father figure feeds the kid then is conditioned to respond to that figure. And all of that was sort of percolating around as the mainstream viewpoint when Harry Harlow came up with the cloth and wire mother. And cloth mom is just really a warm roll of terry cloth. There's a light bulb inside that makes it warm. It's squishy and soft and padded enough that if a baby monkey clings to it, it folds around the monkey just a little bit, enough to give the sense of, you know, getting a little bit of a hug back. And wire mom is like chicken wire, you know, smooth, and offering a lot of climbing surfaces in between those sort of holes in the wire. Also warm. Baby animals, baby primates like us and monkeys need to be warm. And in the simplest, the experiment did this. They would put cloth mom and wire mom side by side. Only wire mom has the milk. And the psychology of the time said, well, then, the baby monkey's going to spend all their time with the mother that has the milk because that's the reinforcing relationship. And, in fact, what Harlow's experiment showed was exactly the opposite. These little babies lived on cloth mom. They wanted that warm, soft touch. They wanted to cuddle. They wanted that sense of being held. They wanted it more than they wanted the sense of being fed. And if you watch them for 24 hours, they'd spend about 23 of them on cloth mom. There's some great photos. I think there's one in the center section of Lovett Goon Park of a monkey holding on to cloth mom but leaning over to drink the milk from wire mom. And when you take that further, you say, okay, this is really important to the baby. Well, does it affect the way it develops? It turned out we made an enormous difference. Not just that, you know, they like to be touched, but that not being touched basically derailed the normal path of development.
But they weren't really touched by the cloth mom. They were just there to feel the warmth. There was no interaction.
Right. It was a real interesting thing because when they first came up with cloth mom, these babies looked pretty good. I mean, they cuddled all the time. And when you took them and you put them in like a strange situation, you know, a new room with a bunch of weird toys, they would cling to this cloth mother. She would make them feel secure, right, just in the clinging. They'd go out and explore. And it was a real contrast from the wire mother because she didn't give them any of that sense of security, and they'd just lie on the floor and basically weep until they were taken out of the strange situation. But as they grew up, it was clear that these guys did not know how to interact with other monkeys. And as Harlow went further into it, You see him saying, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute, what's missing, what's missing? You know, what does a mother have to give a baby? And so this first discovery was, yes, you know, psychology, you are dead wrong. A mother has to give a sense. Has to be soft and cuddly, and the baby has to be able to hold on and feel sort of warmed and cuddled. But it's not enough, because basically these are social animals. We are social animals, and one of the most important things that a parent does is teach you about interacting with each other. And that takes you all the way into adulthood, right? Your mother, in the monkey's case, you know, the mother teaches the baby about grooming, about cues, facial expressions, what's an affectionate touch, what's a hostile touch, you know, what kind of signals do you make. We do the exact same thing with our kids. You know, our kids learn from us that smiles show a positive response, that frowns or fear faces show something else. And that's really why you see that if you have children who are severely neglected by their parents, you know, extreme neglect, those kids, more than any other kids that social scientists have studied, have a terrible time going on and learning and developing other relationships. Yeah, you know, by the time they're in kindergarten, you see them as the children who have the hardest time making friends. And so Cloth Mom's big failure, among other things, is that she's a statue. She can keep you warm. She can be a home base. She can't teach you a thing about interacting with anyone else. And that's our life story. You know, we're a social species. We depend on those connections.
Let's take that then to neglected or abused or castaway children. Are there studies that have been done affirmatively on children from that background, or are we only applying what we learned in the cloth monkey, wire monkey studies of Harry Harlow?
Well, one of the nice thing about Harry Harlow's work is that those monkey studies have since been demonstrated over and over again in kids. And I need to say at this moment that, you know, a lot of people will look at those early Harlow studies. These were done in the late 50s, early 60s for the most part. And they'll say, well, you know, we know that from kids. We know that kids don't do well if, you know, their mothers don't pick them up. We know that isolated children do poorly. But in fact, if you look at what psychology was in general saying at the time, the field was blowing off human observation, and it wasn't until you got this really good animal data that people started going back and looking at people in a more sort of methodical, accepting way. If a mother rejects a child, in monkeys or in people, the child will spend most of its energy trying to repair that relationship, to the detriment of other relationships. And we see that in monkeys, and we see that in people. If you go and you look at human studies of neglected kids, say they have the human version of a cloth mother who just doesn't teach them anything about, doesn't interact with them, doesn't smile back at them when they smile. That, to me, is something you hear a lot from people who work with neglected kids. The child smiles at the mother doesn't smile back. After a while, the child quits smiling at people. What does it get? It hasn't learned that a smile gets you any kind of positive response. They don't even understand it. And these little kids go off to school and they don't smile at other kids when other kids smile at them.
We're talking with Deborah Blum, the author of a new book entitled Love at Goon Park, The Study of Harry Harlow and the Science of Affection. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Deborah, you mention mothers and the way mothers interact with children. And in your book, you describe the criticism that Harry Harlow received from many feminists talking about mothers. Is what you're saying an active parent, or is it the female parent?
Well, you know, that's a really good point. And, you know, and I tend, because I've been living in Harry Harlow's time, to say mother, in part because the species he studied, the rhesus macaque, is a species in which the females really do the parenting. And I really, by mother, mean parent. Many, many studies have been done since this that show that as long as you have a strong parent figure, be it mother, father, aunt, uncle, cousin.
Or any other human.
Or any other human. Does not have to be a biological parent who is really there for you, smiles back at you in the way I was just describing. You're going to do fine. So, you know, I'm using mother in the Harlow sense to mean parent figure, and I appreciate you catching me on that. And Harry himself was a... If you really get into his writing, he says it doesn't have to be the mother. You have to have a strong parent. But he also felt that mothers were really important to healthy development of children. And he was really impatient with the feminist movement of the time. And this is the late 60s, early 70s by now, when this, you know, when the feminist movement is really pushing against those old definitions of traditional parenting. And they want to get mom out of the house. And he wants to say, wait a minute. You also have to consider the needs of kids. And he does this, in my opinion, no one could have done this worse. I mean, he's so impatient and prickly and angry with the movement that, you know, I don't think he got his message across. I think he took shots at the women's movement, and they just shot right back. You know, what got lost in that argument was kids. And when I read some of his stuff, I want to say, oh, don't do that, Harry, you know, because you've got some really good points here. Yes, kids do have needs. We have to pay attention to them. Could you have said this differently?
Let's talk about the concept or the argument of nature versus nurture. And you're a person who has written a great deal about brain structure and how the brain relates to sex and sexual identity and sexual behavior, which seems to me is much more genetically related. Yet what you're talking about and writing about in Love at Goon Park and Harry Harlow's study is nurture. How do you distinguish between the two?
I think that they dance together all the time. And I think, you know, we weren't born a rock. Our brain is incredibly responsive to experience. I think that's one of the great stories of the success of the human species, is that we respond all the time. And so you can actually see, and there's all kinds of great science available, that the brain adjusts daily, even if it needs to different experience. Hormone levels will go up and down depending on how your life is turning out. The best example of that is testosterone, which is, you know, the most wonderful hormonal sort of measurement of what your life is like.
I find it so.
Oh, I think testosterone is a fascinating hormone. And if you look at the brains of kids, you will find that experience causes genes to express differently. So that one of the arguments that actually began in Harlow's time and continues today is that affection, going back to affection, can help certain genes express in the brain and strengthen or help develop certain brain structures. And lack of affection and hostile treatment by your parent figure can do the opposite. And in fact, both in animals like the ones Harlow studied and in children, you see that if you are the child of, say, an abusive parent, your brain will look really different in terms of the whole stress response system.
I want to ask about that because you mentioned that first relationships are enormously influential and experience causes genes to express differently. Tell us what you mean, particularly about first relationships. It's obvious that if it's a first, there is nothing preceding, no preceding relationship to which it can be compared.
There's a lot of evidence that shows, and this goes back to your emotional bedrock question, that we begin to build our sense of security and connection to others with those early relationships. And they can be more than one. But that our biology, the primate biology really, tends to suggest that we cling to one central figure first. And that relationship is really profound in then the way we develop. And in fact, just in February of 2003, I heard some presentation from the National Institutes of Health on this, in which they looked at baby monkeys again, who were born with a kind of jittery, anxious their genetics tended them to be toward a jittery, anxious system, and it particularly involves serotonin. And they could take those monkeys, put them with foster monkeys, and find that the parenting trumped the genetics, and that those kids, even inheriting this sort of anxious personality type, were much calmer and did much better with relationships if they had a warm, nurturing parent figure.
And that would cause the chemical secretion of serotonin that would affect a personality change or outer attitudinal changes.
That's right. The expression of the genes that code for serotonin were directly affected by the type of parenting you get. I think we're just figuring out what you might think of as the mechanics of this, but it's very clear that early experience, you know, affects your development structurally, and that means that parenting can have an enormous effect on the shape that your brain might take. It doesn't make you, like, not human. It just means that certain facets may develop better than others.
Are these tests being conducted by using blood samples and analyzing the serotonin levels?
Yes. They do serotonin analysis. They do brain imaging to go with it. They do genetic analysis to look at the specific genes that express for serotonin transport.
What is the source of the subjects or the people, if they are people, who are tested in these studies?
The study I just described was working specifically with monkeys, again, of the same species Harry Harlow studied. But the studies that have been done in humans tend to be something like this. They take particularly two groups of adults, those who come from abusive households or neglectful households, and those who come from what we would call normal households, right, or households where you have a basically supportive parental situation. And they image the brain, and they look at the different structures that handle, in this case, stress response. And this would be not so much. This is a different but sort of match set. They look at the, it's like the adrenal. It's the system that involves the release of adrenaline. And they see that it's distinctly different in those adults who came up from an abusive household, those adults who came up from a nurturing one. It looks exactly like the system that you get when you put animals into a stressful situation or with indifferent parents. So they know that, you know, it's the same sort of developmental thing. And so they'll look both at the structures of the brain, and then they'll measure the hormone release in response to stressful situations. And then they have tried some with children cross-fostering. Much harder to do this, you know, in kids. Do you let scientists play God with a kid? Okay, your biological mother isn't the best mother for you. We're going to pick this mother and see if we can alter, you know, the path of your development. But I will tell you, when people have gone sort of retroactively and looked at children who were adopted out and done, you know, these kinds of analyses, they find that children who were sort of serendipitously placed in really good nurturing homes, you see this same kind of corrective effect.
You talk about how Harry Harlow liked to challenge scientific authority. He was somewhat radical, to say the least, in his treatment of the monkeys who he studied.
Are you thinking about his extreme experiments, or are you thinking about the fact that he really liked to take on the mainstream point of view, that he really liked a good fight?
That he liked to take on the fight and challenge the underlying scientific theories.
He did. He loved to challenge assumptions. You know, he used to say that he hoped that one day science would catch up with common sense.
Well, in your studies of Harlow, do you think that he just kind of wandered into this arena of studying the monkeys with the cloth mother and the wire mother? Or do you think that he had an analysis and a plan that he sequenced through when he was creating his study plan?
No, I mean, I think some of both. I think that he was a scientist who tended to let ideas sort of unfold before him. He really accidentally became a primate researcher because the University of Wisconsin in the 1930s, when he came there, didn't give him the rat lab they had promised him. And he ended up down at the zoo finally looking at monkeys, and one thing led to another. And then he went on from there to just watch them. He was a wonderful observer. He really paid attention. And he thought monkeys were smart. And that was his first big sort of attack on mainstream psychology. Mainstream psychology said, well, monkeys can't really think. And he spent 15 years proving that wrong. And then he took on love. And I think he did it for two reasons. One was he'd been watching them. He saw that monkeys who had a lot of social connection did better, were smarter on his tests, in fact. But the other part was he was married to a child psychologist. And I think she pushed him that way. She was really interested in that. So he also happened to work with really smart people. And, you know, it's nice when you look at the way he writes it, he'll say it. This was a great idea. It wasn't mine, I thought, not with love, but sometimes he'll say, one of my students came up with this idea. I thought they were wrong. Boy, did I make a fool of myself. I mean, he's real candid and open about that kind of thing.
Well, Deborah Blum, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Life of Pi, an allegorical story of a boy and a tiger on a boat trip across the ocean. And it is a really fascinating book.
And who is the author?
It's Yann Martel, M-A-R-T-E-L. He's a Canadian writer. It's another one of those books that sort of plays with the margins of reality. I really liked it.
Deborah Blum, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
It's been my pleasure.
Deborah Blum is the author of Love at Goon Park, Harry Harlow and the Science of Affection. The book that she recommends is The Life of Pi by Yann Martel. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.